What the Health on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everybody. You're listening to What the Health here on FUBAR Radio with me, Clara Hermit. I hope that you are having a great start to your day. And as always, we are here to bring you all things health and well-being. This is a space that I have been in for years as a PT, as a women's self-love and empowerment coach, and it's a topic that I will forever be interested in because essentially it's the topic that shapes our whole entire life, how we think about ourselves, how we feel about ourselves, what we believe about ourselves. And when it comes to our physical fitness, we cannot take away from the fact that our physical fitness is so interlinked with our mental fitness as well. So this show encompasses all of that. And we've got some great guests coming up on today's show. And of course, I'll be answering some of your questions. Now, I'm going to read this statistic, which is, I mean, I don't know if it's shocking or not, but I think things have not changed and potentially have got worse when it comes to talking about eating disorders, because research has shown that eating disorders affect nearly 21% of young women and that roughly 2 to 3 million UK adults of all ages have been affected at some point in their lives by eating disorders. Talia Cicchelli is a specialised dietitian who works primarily with eating disorders and disordered eating. With over 12 years of clinical experience throughout public and private hospitals, she is also the principal dietitian and founder of Talia Cicchelli Nutrition, and she joins me now in the studio. How are you? It's great to have you joining us. And as I said in that intro there, like reading that statistic, it is still shocking to know that actually, you know, since I was young, I don't think things have got better, have they? It seems like they're getting worse.
It's getting worse. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
what contributes to that?
Oof, so many things. I think the society that we live in at the moment, there's such a pressure to be, you know, looking a certain way, being a thin body. We've got the rise of weight loss medication, which I know you spoke about recently. So I think there's, you know, a link there. There's an increase in social media use and the harmful messages and images and editing, you know, editing apps on how we look. So I think there's a lot of real unrealistic expectations and views about what health and nutrition looks like. And so it's very confusing. There's a lot of misinformation, and a lot of the people that I support are just really confused as to how to eat, what's normal eating. It's a really hard time to focus on finding that balance.
It's kind of like the wild, wild west, isn't it? A little bit. And there's so many, like you say, different things pulling people in so many different directions. What made you decide to pursue this career? Where did that kind of interest and passion come from for you?
Yeah, so in graduating, I never wanted to work in this space within the dietetic field. I think a lot of dietitians and nutritionists, when they graduate, are quite nervous working in mental health and eating disorders in particular, because partly we don't learn much about it. Mm-hmm. So it was a 1-hour lecture in a 4-year university degree. And again, there's a lot of stigma, isn't there? Just being a human being, first and foremost. And so it wasn't until I accepted a role a few years after graduating in a pediatric hospital in Australia, in Sydney. And one of the wards I was allocated on my first day was the adolescent eating disorders ward. And I fell in love with it. Mm. I was like, this is where I'm meant to be. I think especially with dietetic degrees is that a lot of how we're taught and the approach to nutrition that we're taught about as well is very traditional, weight-centric. And so to work in a space where you're able to really, build relationships and get to know a person's relationship with food and their body and family systems, it's a really special place to work as a dietitian.
Yeah, and I guess you're helping people who really, really need it as well, and who, you know, as someone who's experienced an eating disorder, there's a lot of feeling hopeless.
Yeah,
there's a lot of feeling like there's no way out, and you're kind of trapped in that cycle. So, I guess having someone who makes you feel like there is, it could be incredibly powerful. Why is it actually meeting the diagnosed criteria for eating disorders so difficult? What are the criteria?
Yeah, so an eating disorder is diagnosed against criteria in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual for Eating Disorders.
Oh, sounds fun.
Such a mouthful always, the DSM-5, 5th edition. And so for each category of eating disorders, so your main ones are anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and binge eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And then a category which not many people are aware of is OSFED, so other specified feeding and eating disorders. That's actually the largest category within the DSM-5 for eating disorders. About 45 to 50% of eating disorder diagnoses will fall into that category.
Okay.
A lot of people, I think most people are aware of anorexia nervosa, which accounts for about 8% of all eating disorder diagnoses. So within each of those, there is a set of criteria. So it could be related to how a person values themselves and their body. It could be the severity of weight loss. It could be the level of dietary restriction, how often someone engages in compensatory behaviours such as vomiting, laxative use or exercise. So there is a set of criteria for each of those that someone would have to meet. And there's also a timeline as well. So, for example, engaging in X compensatory behaviours within the last 3 months.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the issue with the diagnostic criteria is that it is very clinical, it's very tick box, but what we know about relationship with food is that it's a spectrum. And so when we think about relationship with food, we've got healthy, intuitive, flexible eating down one end, clinically diagnosed eating disorders down the other, and then in between we have disordered eating. And I think that's what's really on the rise. There's a lot of disordered eating prevalent at the moment, and it's become so normalised as well. So I think that's one of the issues that a lot of people face, is actually recognising that they are engaging in disordered eating behaviours and it may be developing into an eating disorder.
It's hearing you talk about it, I think, so I guess started probably with disordered eating, which was like, I want to lose weight, so I'm just going to really restrict what I'm eating to do that. But also my mum died when I was a kid, and food became my support system and my friend, essentially. I think it was one of the ways that I survived that time.
Yeah.
So the kind of restricting of food became more difficult because, you know, if there was something emotional that was happening, I wanted to eat. So it was actually, and this is why, you know, talking about social media and people seeing things on social media, but it was a conversation I had with a friend of mine about her and another friend, you know, binging and making themselves sick, that put that kind of idea firmly into my head, and thus kind of my experience with bulimia, which lasted a long time, started. And I think even post kind of managing to stop making myself sick, stop taking laxatives, stop the over-exercising, for years after that, you know, I have still had issues with binge eating or with overeating, you know. And it's so complex. But I think one of the biggest things for me is, because my mum passed away when I was 9.
Mm.
And one of the things that she had done was, you know, healthy eating was, you know, kind of important in our family. And there wasn't ever really restrictions on how much we ate. But, you know, it was kind of like we didn't have loads of chocolate. We didn't have loads of sweets. We didn't have, you know, they were kind of treats. And that was that. And when she died, that completely shifted and changed. And there was no boundaries, no rules, no anything. And because for so long, so from the age of 9, I have been I was overeating. I was eating too much, sometimes so much I'd be sick because I'd eaten so much. You know, as an adult, I didn't know. Like, it took me a long time to work out, you know, what is normal for me? How much should I be eating? You know, what in terms of, I know what I should eat and what's kind of good for me and how to have balance and how not to restrict things now, but also like how much. And so it's just, what's something that should be kind of intuitive and you would hope natural to us, it's so interesting how it's so warped for so many of us.
Yeah.
What is the distinction and difference between disordered eating and an eating disorder?
Yeah, so an eating disorder meets the
criteria.
DSM-5 criteria.
Yeah.
So disordered eating doesn't have a set of criteria, which makes it really difficult to identify.
Mm-hmm.
From the perspective of people getting help, because if we think about NHS services, you know, mostly they're only providing support for an eating disorder. So when we think about even the struggle people are experiencing to receive support, we have to think about what are services providing.
Mm.
A lot of the time, you know, there's so much stigma and judgment and shame around talking about disordered eating and eating disorders. So I think that that's a huge barrier. And, you know, I've worked with so many people who have gone to their GP to get help and they have come back feeling very invalidated. So there is definitely an element of awareness. And I also think, you know, living in the UK, there's so much cultural diversity. And when I worked in an eating disorder service in East London and we were using interpreters, one of the things you wouldn't even think about is you would be hearing the interpreter speak in the native language and then they'd say the words eating disorder or anorexia. And it makes you think, well, actually, if there's no word for that in that language, how are we going to support this family to understand? So when we look at disordered eating, you know, some of the things that I think about are, is your relationship with food in any way causing you distress or worry or guilt with, you know, with regards to the decisions that you're making about food and your body? Is it impacting any other area of your life? So are you able to eat socially without feeling anxious? Are you able to travel without having to look up restaurants and cafes and check the menus? Are you able to eat out and not be worried about the calories that are now present on menus? Are you able to exercise in a way where you're not looking at calories burned and having that sort of push and pull relationship between calories in, calories out? So there's lots of behaviours that we can identify within disordered eating. So, you know, skipping meals, eating in a very irregular pattern or having long fast periods of fasting, avoiding whole food groups or certain foods and classifying foods as good or bad, which is really common. So avoiding carbs, avoiding certain fats, always choosing lower fat products and being fearful of full fat dairy, full fat yogurt. Really limiting the variety of foods that you might eat. So avoiding foods that have sugar or are classified as, you know, processed foods or packaged foods. And really being quite rigid with how you approach food. So that might look like calorie counting, using MyFitnessPal to track food. And I'm not saying that that's a behaviour that no one can engage in, but it's when it becomes unhealthy. So when I think about what normal eating is, and maybe that's a way to sort of reverse it, is that normal eating encompasses sort of five key pillars, I guess you could say. So one is eating regularly. The other is eating adequately. So being able to eat enough to fuel your life. Eating a variety of foods, being able to eat socially, and being able to be flexible with eating. So if you're experiencing the opposite of any of those things, and that's an opportunity to really just take a breath and be curious about what's impacting your relationship with food.
It's so interesting hearing you kind of say all of those, because I think, you know, for the most part of my 20s, that was me. You know, I think about going on a family holiday to Thailand and I would only eat kind of chicken skewers because, and my sister was really angry with me because everyone knew what was happening, but, you know, people want to help you, but they don't know how. And, you know, the fact that I had acceptable foods and unacceptable foods. So if I had one of the unacceptable foods, that would trigger a binge and then, you know, like purging. That's just, and to think that, you know, now as a 42-year-old woman, kind of looking back and thinking that was my life for 10 plus years. And it felt like I was, I was not in control. Every day I would wake up saying, this is going to be it. I'm never doing this again. And every day I'd fail. And I think I lost hope so many times when I was kind of in that cycle. And also looking back, I had therapy for eating disorders for the first time when I was 18, having my, I guess, bulimia started when I was 15. But I don't think I ever went to the doctor and spoke. I don't think I ever went and spoke to them. So I didn't have any kind of really specialised help. It was therapy that my dad kind of forced me to go to. And the next time when I was in my 20s was I found eating disorder, a therapist who specialised in eating disorders, and I went there myself. And I think that I also, the biggest change for me and I guess the way that I saw my body and eating was I had a preventative double mastectomy because both my mum and sister died of breast cancer. And when that happened, I lost a lot of interest in my appearance and I started questioning everything. Like, where do these beliefs come from around beauty standards and, you know, all of that stuff. And it kind of crumbled down a lot for me. But there was definitely, and I gave up, I became vegan, funnily enough, but in becoming vegan, I gave up control. Like, no food was good or bad. Like, everything, with as long as it was vegan, was acceptable. And my body changed as a result. I put on weight and et cetera, but I felt really happy and I felt like free. And then now I'm in a place where it's funny you talk about kind of counting calories, because I'm now in a place where it's like, I want to, you know, grow muscle and be strong and work, support my bone density as I'm aging and all of those things. And it's the first time in my life where I can stick to something without, you know, without falling out of consistency. It doesn't feel hard and horrible, and there is nothing that's restricted. I am counting calories, but it's not crazy. I'm very aware of that, and it doesn't feel like a pressure. It doesn't feel like a rule. It doesn't feel strict, and it feels really healthy. And I feel better than I have ever felt before. But it's only at this point in my life that I can do it. So recovery sometimes takes a long time.
It does, yeah.
What does recovery look like when it comes to an eating disorder? Because I guess it's different for everyone, isn't it? But how does someone start?
Yeah, it is different for everyone. And that's one of the challenges when you're in recovery, is that comparison of, you know, why is it taking so long? Mm. Why is X person in a different place to me? I think the statistics are that on average, recovery is a 6 to 7 year journey. Mm-hmm. In my experience with a lot of the people I work with, it is longer. And it's not to say that you're, you know, in a place throughout that whole period that you are medically compromised or it's, you know, it's unsafe. Mm. But I think definitely from a starting point is, if you can, just to talk to someone that you know is there to support you and that is going to validate your concerns, whether that be a family member, a friend, going to your GP, having that conversation. In an ideal world, that would be the best stepping stone to then be, you know, referred to the local eating disorder service for an assessment, or to be given, you know, directions to different resources and different supports available, such as BEAT, so the UK's eating disorder charity, which has incredible amount of free resources support groups. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a starting point. Mm-hmm. If you're in a position, then I think being able to refer yourself to a therapist, as you did, and or, you know, a dietitian, and really just starting to open up that conversation and, you know, be curious about, you know, what has been influencing your relationship with food. Is it serving you? So as you said, you know, you're currently engaging in calorie counting behaviours, but there's flexibility, there's freedom, and the intention sounds like it's a healthy one. Mm-hmm. Versus in the past, that intention was being driven by maybe an unhealthy desire to change your body weight and shape. Yeah. So we have to be curious about what's the intention, and that's a conversation that I have with all of my clients. And so, yeah, first step, trying to access support services if you can. And I think another area to really look at is increasing that awareness and becoming aware of where maybe social media is influencing your thoughts and beliefs about food. Doing a little bit of a social media detox can be really helpful. Mm-hmm. And there's loads of free information online, recovery focused podcasts, blogs. So really trying to surround yourself by information that is going to support you having a healthy relationship with food, rather than being pulled into, you know, the misinformation that we often see online.
I think the social media side of things is really scary, because I mean, it's bad enough now as an adult, but when you're, you know, if that had been around when I was in the kind of space that I was in, I mean, it was bad anyway, but I can imagine that would have made it a whole lot worse, because every time you are getting somewhere, like you're talking about with recovery, if you then see a couple of videos, it can then kind of switch you back to the way of thinking previously, and the work that you've done kind of tumbles away. So I guess it can be really, 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 really triggering and really difficult. One thing that I wanted to talk about, because I think, and we haven't got that long left, but just quickly that I wanted to touch on, because a lot of people don't know this, is that when you do have an eating disorder, especially, well, depending on how much weight you lose, right, you can, your period can stop, right, and it can affect your fertility. And I think a lot of people don't know that. So can we just touch on why that is?
Yeah.
And what happens?
Yeah. So, period loss is really common with when someone has an eating disorder or disordered relationship with food. And firstly, I just want to really reinforce that losing your period is not normal. Mm-hmm. I know that has been normalised in, you know, online, especially in sort of the fitness space. So I just really want to start with that and reinforce that. And also that you can lose your period at any body shape or size.
Right.
And recovering your period doesn't necessarily mean that you're at a healthy weight for you.
Mm-hmm.
So when we think about period loss, there's three key factors that can influence it. One is dietary restrictions, energy restriction or nutrient deficiencies, and healthy level of exercise, especially one that's not not being fueled
yes,
correctly. So there's that relationship between then your nutrition intake and exercise levels. Mm-hmm. And the third is psychological stress or stress on mm-hmm. the body. So we even saw this during the pandemic where a lot of women's cycles became irregular or women lost their period for no reason other than the psychological stress that a lot of people were facing. So when someone isn't eating adequately, the analogy I like to use is that it's similar to your phone going in low battery mode or battery saving
right.
mode. So if we think about each app on your phone being the equivalent of different body systems or organs, is that when your body's not being fueled with enough energy or calories, then your body has to decide, well, which of these apps am I going to start to put into battery saving mode?
Wow.
And one of the most common ones for humans who menstruate is your menstrual cycle and fertility, because if your body thinks that it's in a state of stress or in famine, then biologically it's not going to want to house a baby.
Mm-hmm.
So, they're the three sort of common factors that would influence someone losing their period with an eating disorder.
That's such a great analogy as well, though, like a really powerful analogy, just be like your body's gone, okay, the other one, like your heart, your lungs, etc., we need those to keep living, but actually let's put this on hold because right now we don't have the energy to facilitate the running of this system, essentially,
yes.
isn't
yes,
it?
Exactly.
I do feel like, you know, I hope, and we had this discussion last week, we were talking about the whole body positivity movement, etc. I think, you know, maybe I've been a bit naive in the, because my relationship with my body has changed in kind of thinking that actually, yay, you know, we're living in a better space where, you know, where women are encouraged to just embrace the body that they do have and to not spend so much time stressing and worrying about their physical body and the importance of their physical appearance. But actually, I kind of realize when I speak to people outside of, you know, maybe my like my friendship group, that actually that's not necessarily the case. And actually that we may be in a worse situation. And I think touching on the kind of the weight loss drugs, because that's been such a big topic of conversation over the last, I guess, 18 months. It's just gone mad. And we're seeing this kind of return to people being super skinny and I feel like I'm in a place where none of it doesn't bother me anymore, but I imagine this is having a big impact on the kind of psyche of especially women everywhere.
Yes. Yeah, I'm definitely seeing it in clinic. And the really frightening thing is that, especially with weight loss medications, is that they can be purchased privately and, you know, in the online. And yeah, it's such a scary time to be living and trying to heal your relationship with food when, you know, there's these temptations out there. I'm similar to you, is that, you know, I have a really, you know, strong community around me that has a healthy relationship with food. And sometimes I feel exactly the same and people will talk to me in clinic about things they've seen online and I'm like, oh, I haven't seen that because I'm not engaging in that content. I often miss, you know, the trends when they first come out. And that's one of the challenges that a lot of the people I support face, is that within their, you know, what I call like their closest bubble or network, is that their friends are engaging in disordered eating, their mum's dieting, their, you know, their dad's on this medication. And so what actually, you know, they don't have any good role models of what a healthy, strong relationship with food looks like. And that can be really difficult as well.
Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine. I think as well, that environment that we're in is having such a big impact on us, isn't it? Look, it's been so great to talk to you. I feel like I could speak to you for the whole hour. I only got about a quarter way through all of my questions for you. And for people who are listening who want to find out more about what you do and, you know, find you online, where do they need to go?
Yeah, so on Instagram, TC Nutrition, or you can head to my website, taliachakelly.com.
Talia, it's been lovely to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much.
No worries. And coming up next, I'm going to be speaking to Betty Mukherjee. We've got lots more coming up after this break.
FUBAR Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
You might then see friends, family that require a little bit of support, financial advice. How do you go about sharing that advice, sharing that support without being condescending?
A practical tip that everyone can do that is low friction, send them financial content that you like. If you have a favorite content creator, if you see an article that you like, send them the video and just ask them, what do you think? And then that can begin a conversation around it.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favorite shows such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google app stores. The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way. From this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
Couple Goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
When is too early to say I love you? Soph said it the night we met.
Yeah. Right, let's just clear this up, right? When I said I love you, I remember I said it in the car.
In the cab, yeah.
In the cab, and I was like, oh my God, I love you.
Yeah, that was the day I made you my girlfriend, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I said, I love you, and you were like, I love you too. And I was like, I love you so much, oh my God, I love you.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
We store so much of our trauma and our energy in our body. I am just incredibly, incredibly tired of keeping this trauma locked inside my body. And so all I needed to do is release it. You know, it's like going on a bender and drinking too much booze and you throw it up because you just need to get that out of your system because it's gonna catch up with you at some point if you don't.
Keeping fitness fun. What the Health on FUBAR Radio.
Yeah, you're listening to Clara Hermit. It's FUBAR Radio. We have already had a great conversation with Talia Cacelli, who joined us in the studio to talk about eating disorders, which is such an important topic to discuss. And even the idea of disordered eating, which I think so many people experience. And it's funny how there's a crossover. If you missed last week's show, don't forget you can go back and listen on all good podcasting platforms where we were speaking all about this idea that, you know, the environment that we grow up in, the things we learn from our parents about food and eating and our relationship with food and diet and our bodies is so ingrained. So it was so great to chat to Talia about some of that. Now, I have got some questions from you. And don't forget, if you have a question and you would like to get involved in the show, you can DM me at WhatTheHealthShow on Instagram. That is the place to DM all your questions about physical health. We can talk about about mental health as well, please do get in touch. I've had this one that says, I have very little experience with weightlifting, but it's something I'd like to get into. What are the benefits of getting into weights as a woman? There's so many benefits, I think, for getting into weights. But, you know, number one is, and this is something that is a recommendation, is that all women should be lifting weights because it increases our bone density. And as we get older and our hormones shift and change, you know, we are at risk of osteoporosis. So having good bone density is really important. But also it's about having muscles that support your joints. And I think, you know, personally for me, it just is it's a really nice way to exercise. It's a really nice way to feel good. And I think that obviously any kind of exercise, you're releasing endorphins. And it's also, for me, you know, weightlifting is something that gives me a great sense of achievement. As I see, you know, myself getting stronger and being able to lift heavier, that's something that I really, you know, really relish and makes me feel really good. And I do think as women, it's good to be, you know, mentally strong, to be physically strong, and to really take care of our bodies. And if you have no idea where to start and you're going to a gym, if you can afford to work with a personal trainer, even for a short period of time, that's going to be great to help you perfect form. But if you can't do that, there are very often in gyms classes that will help you if you are a beginner at weightlifting to learn how to do the correct techniques. As well as that, there are also gym instructors at your gym that can help you perfect techniques. So don't let the fact that you're a beginner put you off doing something that you really want to do. We all have to start somewhere. And I think learning something new is another thing that can make us feel really good and really empowered. So I hope that helps. And don't forget, if you have a question, go to Instagram and go to What The Health Show. Next, joining me on the show is Betty Mukherjee, known for competing in Channel 4's Race Across the World Series 4, where she spoke openly about being born with MRKH, a condition that affects one in every 5,000 women. Betty doesn't have a womb and has one kidney, and she's been widely involved in raising awareness about the condition. Hello, Betty. How are you?
Hello. Good morning. I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
No worries. It's an absolute pleasure. So I said in the introduction that you have MRKH. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that is and how it affects you?
Yeah. So like you said, it's classed as a rare condition, but one in 5,000 women's not really that rare to say, like how little it's sort of talked about or known. But it's characterized, like you say, with those abnormalities in a woman's reproductive system. So I was born without a uterus. And like you said, I've only got one kidney as well. So that's actually type 2 of MRKH. Type 2 can affect different organs, spinal, heart, hearing. So yeah, that is, in a nutshell, that is what MRKH is.
And you were diagnosed at 16. What was it like when you were diagnosed? How did that feel?
It was, I mean, like I always say, being a teenager is hard enough. Being a teenage girl is hard enough. You know, your body's changing. You've got things like friendships to consider. And, you know, are you going to change schools? Are you going to do your A levels? Like, you know, all those big decisions that feel like huge life decisions anyway. And then to be told something like that was, it was really challenging to kind of navigate, because I was in, you know, circle of girl groups where they were all getting their periods and they were all talking about what colour tampons they were using and different pads and things like that, and conversations that I just could not join in. So it was a really tough time to navigate, yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine that it must have been really difficult. What made you decide you wanted to talk about it publicly?
So it was a conversation that I kind of had with the producers leading up to Race Across the World. And it was something that even up until the day before we went, we were having conversations about naming the condition or just leaving it very open with like sort of fertility. And I think in the end, it was that factor of like, I'm never going to have this voice again to be the voice that I didn't have at 16. So, you know, when I went home and Googled MRKH, there was no one talking about it. And I just thought, if one girl could, you know, get her diagnosis, log on to Instagram and see that someone else is talking about it and it's going to be okay, then that's all that kind of mattered to me.
And it does make such a big difference, doesn't it, representation? Because I think it's like that idea of, okay, I've got this diagnosis now. And like you said, your experience is then different to all of your friends at that age. And you do kind of, then you're like, you're looking around because you want someone else that you can relate to. And I guess that shows you that life's going to be okay, essentially, you know, because at that point when you're so young as well, it's hard to conceptualize that it will be, or how it is going to work out, or, you know, how it is all going to come together. So I imagine that you've had kind of feedback from, you know, girls and women who have seen you and gone, oh my God, thank God that you're there and that you're speaking about it, right? Has that happened a lot?
I mean, it's been a complete range. I've even had sort of mums of daughters that have been diagnosed. I've had really young girls that have been diagnosed. But also I remember like one moment that really sticks with me is when I just came off the race. She was about a 64-year-old woman, and she said she didn't even know her condition had a name. So she'd gone her whole life basically not having sort of that identity to put with it. So I think, I've had a complete range, and it's all been definitely worth it.
And that's, you know, in and of itself, it's amazing, isn't it? Because I think the whole medical system, we know, are not particularly good with women's health anyway. There hasn't been that much research done into it. They're not very, you know, versed or necessarily have a lot of knowledge around women's health because the research doesn't exist. But the fact that things are moving on and that things are changing, and, you know, in a way, I guess they're changing because people who have conditions or who have, you know, experience different things are speaking about it openly, and that's allowing other people to not feel so isolated. So when it comes to your condition, are there any kind of treatments? What does that look like?
So I think, again, this is something that I've tried to really be open about, because I felt at 16 that there was no way through, and I knew at 16 that I wanted to be a mum. So I've really made it my mission to be like, there are options and there are choices. So most women with MRKH will still have their ovaries and they will still have their own eggs. So there is that option to freeze them, make them into embryos, use them in surrogacy later on. Or there is the womb transplant program, which has been now successfully run throughout the UK. So there is that option there. And it's funny because the year I got my diagnosis was the first ever womb transplant in Sweden, 12 years ago.
Wow.
And so I kind of have grown up with that hope that that would just be the done thing. I mean, it's not being rolled out as regularly as I thought it would be at this point, but it's definitely happening. So I think there is so much hope for young girls getting the diagnosis around this time. But I think the main thing is, like, advocate for yourself in appointments, ask the questions, because we are, you know, we have a right to have those options and to know about them.
And that's so important as well, isn't it? Like you saying, but when you're young, I guess you might not know necessarily the right questions to ask, or you might feel unconfident, or you might just feel so overwhelmed. I guess, it's great to have someone else who has been through that process who is saying, ask those questions. Like, there's nothing to feel embarrassed about. There's nothing to feel ashamed about. And also, I think when it comes to these things, there's no such thing as a stupid question. It's like, you need to understand as much as you possibly can about your condition. And the more you know and the more informed you are, I guess, you know, it probably makes you feel more in control, and, you know, it allows you to kind of manage your world and how you envision things because you have more information, essentially, right?
Definitely. And I mean, I completely echo what you say about there's no stupid questions. I even this morning got a question in my DMs asking where I wee from and if I wee from my bum, because I don't have a uterus.
I mean,
so there really is no stupid questions. Some really people is. You know,
I think that the lack of understanding of the female anatomy never ever fails to understand me. have you seen the videos, the ones that have gone viral, where it's like asking guys if a woman can pee with a tampon in?
And no, I haven't.
It's hilarious, and these are adult men, and most of them are like, no, she has to take it out. And, you know, they've got no idea. And I'm like, you're at the age where some of them have got wedding rings on, you know, like you've had sex with somebody before and you're not even aware that a woman urinates from a different, you know, the mind boggles, you know, it's not that difficult to find out the information.
But
sometimes people's questions are a lot. You've been documenting your experience, your journey, your treatments, etc., on YouTube. What's that process kind of like for you? And you know, I guess that's really important for you because it is then somewhere that you can refer people to, right? When they have kind of questions or if they're going through the same thing.
Yeah. So last September, I did my first round of IVF sort of treatment to freeze embryos. And at first I kind of went to YouTube because I didn't want it to be all over my Instagram feed where I know that there are women on there who struggle with fertility. They might find that quite triggering. Yeah. And so I took that to a different channel to give them the option to watch it if they wanted to. And actually, I mean, documenting it on YouTube was really therapeutic for me because it was like I came home from an appointment, I spoke to my camera, and it was like I just got out all my thoughts and feelings instead of holding it in. And for anyone who watches that kind of series on YouTube will see me cry a lot because I just couldn't stop. I think being injected with hormones and sort of going through that, it was a bit of a wild roller coaster, but I'm really glad that I've kind of got that, like you say, and it's there to refer back to. And this time I've just completed my second round of IVF. I was a lot less emotional because I think I knew what I was expecting. But yeah, I think it's just, for me personally, it's been a really therapeutic process documenting it. And I'm hoping that it will be helpful for other people out there as well to watch.
Yeah, almost like a video journal, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
I always find it interesting at how we, you know, like when it comes to crying or showing emotion, we kind of not feel bad for it, but it's like there's like a, is that okay? Is that not okay? But it's part of, you know, your personal experience. And if you're going to give someone a true representation of your personal experience, you can't do that off camera and then come on camera and be like, and yeah, it was really great. And I feel really upbeat because there's probably moments of both, right? So you kind of want to try and show and represent a truthful experience, don't you? I guess when it comes to these things, so that people who are looking at it are like, okay, you know, it's okay for me to feel like this as well.
Yeah, and I think that is sometimes the hard thing with advocating because you do want to give people hope and, you know, you want to spread that sort of positive awareness, but at the same time you have to be realistic and live through the experience that you are living through. You know, even with the IVF and embryo freezing, I think a lot of people do assume that it's kind of guaranteed that the end result will be a baby, but that is not the case at all. You know, the first round going in, we had 18 embryos and ended up with 2 healthy embryos at the end of the process. So, you know, and everyone said to us, you know, you're young, you're healthy, you'll have no problems. And yet we had 2 out of 18. So, you know, the numbers are not guaranteed at all. And 18 is a good number to start with. It was more like, have hope and take these steps and do this. But also, this is how it can be and it's not easy.
No, but I think to give people hope, people need to know that you go through those hard times and how you deal with them and how you come out the other side. Because if you were just always, yay, it's great and it's fine, there's no problems here, I don't think it's relatable because it doesn't represent the truth of people's experience. Yeah. And I think actually the way that you deal with things is, yes, it's difficult in the moment right now and it's absolutely okay for me to process and have those emotions, but that's not going to be the state I stay in forever. You know, there's still optimism, there's still hope, there's still other things I can do. IVF, I've had friends that have gone through IVF and it's... What a roller coaster. But I, you know, they have all had successful results in the end, and that's been like a beautiful experience to see. So again, it's like that they go through all of that kind of hardship, but then in the end, you know, it's worked out. So that is the light at the end of the tunnel, I guess, isn't it? Just quickly before you go, because we talk about exercise on the show, how important has exercise been for you and your mental health throughout this, well, I guess the whole entire process?
It's been massive, actually. Today I've had my first PT session back this week after having my egg retrieval last week. And during IVF treatment, you know, you get told not to sort of excel. And I find that really challenging because usually I do have quite a routine with my fitness. I like to go to the gym quite often, walks with the dog. And so to kind of scale that back this time around, having done IVF before, I kind of got a real handle on how to move my body in a way that was going to, you know, benefit my brain, my body during the time, you know, keep moving. And I think that's the thing. It doesn't, exercise doesn't always have to be the high rocks, the HIIT classes, the big sweaty workouts, just going and doing something, getting outside. Now it's more springtime. And yeah, just doing something that feels good for your body. And that's going to be different to everyone. But it's been a lifesaver for me at times to just be able to get out and move my body. So very grateful for exercise.
Can relate. And I think you're exactly right. That kind of idea that any movement counts. It doesn't have to be, like you say, high intensity, anything. It can be going for a walk. It can be stretching, but just any kind of movement, it really does boost your mood. And I think it can shift your perspective as well. So it's so important, isn't it? Can I just ask you a question? And if people are listening to this, obviously they can't see what your camera, but is that a picture of a sheep behind you?
Yes.
Ah, cute. I was like, what? I used to have a pet sheep called Scraggles, and I could just see that face. And I was like, is that a sheep? Peering at me from your Zoom. It's very cute. It's very cute indeed. Look, it's been so lovely to talk to you. For people who are listening and they want to follow your journey, keep up to date with everything that you're doing, where do they need to go?
So I'm on Instagram, BettyMuck_. I am, or on YouTube, just BettyMuck. And yeah, you'll find me on there.
Fabulous. So it's been so lovely to talk to you. And yeah, I think what you're doing is amazing. You should be incredibly proud of yourself, because it's not easy to take that leap and make that step to talk about things publicly. But I'm so glad that you have. And yeah, I know that you're going to be helping, or that you already have helped loads of people, and you'll continue to help loads more. So thank you, Betty.
Thank you so much for having me.
No worries. What an absolute dream. The lovely Becky Mukherjee there talking to us all about her diagnosis with MRKH. You're listening to Clara Hermit. This is FUBAR Radio. We're going to take a little break and then I'm going to answer some more of your questions.
FUBAR Radio. Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We are joined by Miss Safia. If I could produce you a salt, what is he like on paper? Sound like we're on Love Island.
Okay. On paper, my type has to have a good soul, good purpose, and calm energy. I'm in my energy era where you've just got to come in and make me happy. I don't need you for anything. I wanna find happiness, and I need him to be kind.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
One in five people in the UK are disabled. And it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
Politics Uncensored.
The more alarming question is, what does this say to victims of these sorts of crimes which have been alleged on them? Essentially, what they'll be looking at is two men who have a huge online influence, who say some of the most disgusting things online and spout off some of the, I think, most dangerous sort of ideas and narratives in the online space, that they've essentially been able to travel to the US while they're still under investigation in multiple countries.
Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on FUBAR Radio.
Are you aware of the tea alarm?
Tell me more. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's this cultural phenomenon that we have in Britain. It's an alarm at 3 p.m. Where everybody in the UK has to have a cup of tea, and if you miss it by a certain number of minutes, you get fined, basically.
This ain't real. This is not real. This is not real. I'm not playing into this. Yeah. You think me watching Keeping Up Appearances, you think Mrs. Bouquet was missing a 3 o'clock tea alarm? Y'all won't get me.
Keeping fitness fun. What the hell on FUBAR Radio.
You are listening to Clara Hermit here on FUBAR Radio. This is What the Health, and it's that time of the show where I answer some of your questions. And if you have any questions that you would like to put to me, that you would like me to answer, please go to Instagram and DM us at What the Health Show. That's the way to do it. That's the way to do it. It sounds like a line from a pantomime. This is not a pantomime, I promise you. It's a very serious show, and we have some great guests, and we've been talking about eating disorders, and this first listener question says, how do I maintain a healthy relationship with food? Now, earlier we spoke to Talia Cicchelli, who was telling us about her job as a dietitian working specifically with people who have eating disorders. And I think, you know, if you are experiencing issues around food or disordered eating, it's really important to seek help from a professional. I am not an eating disorder professional. I do think that when it comes to maintaining a healthy relationship with food, one of the things that Talia touched on and that can have a huge impact on our psyche, on, you know, how we eat, what we eat, is social media. It's such a big part of our lives, and we should not underestimate how much of an impact what we are seeing online is having on us. And, you know, one of the things that Talia suggested is, you know, going through your kind of Instagram feed and getting rid of anything that impacts you negatively. You know, it might not even be an account that's kind of dedicated to anything to do with eating disorders or anything like that, but it might just be that for some particular reason this person's content triggers you in a way that is not healthy, in which case unfollow them. It's not because you don't like them or anything like that, it's because you have to put yourself first. And I think it's also about making sure you're asking yourself questions and checking in with yourself. Talia mentioned the kind of checkpoints of what normal eating is. If you go back and listen to the start of the show, you will hear her talk about those. But I off the top of my head, I remember some of them. I think there were 5 of them in total. But it is kind of regular eating. So eating regularly, it's not having foods that are good or bad or labeled as good or bad. How you feel when you eat as well, because if you're feeling, you know, bad or stressed or anxious around food, then that is a sign that you're not in a healthy space with food, that you can go out socially and eat without even having to think about it. So all of those things, you know, if you are starting to notice that those are shifting or changing, then, then it's definitely worth going and getting some help, some support, finding someone to talk to. And also, you know, Talia and I were both talking about the fact that within our kind of friendship groups, it's people, I guess, eat in really normal ways and have healthy relationships with food. And that's kind of, you know, a bit of an echo for the rest of us as well. And it's not to say that you should stop being friends with people, but it's also just be cautious of how different people make you feel, view yourself and your relationship with food. But again, you know, if this is something that you feel is a problem for you, then it's definitely worth having a talk with a professional, and maybe going looking for some resources just to kind of firm up and reaffirm your relationship with food and keep it in a good space and place. The next one says, how do I overcome an addiction to exercise? Again, I am not an expert in this field, especially around addiction. But my first point of call would be, if that is the case, to go and seek professional help. And this is not something that we should ever be scared of doing. Very often, I think we feel shame and embarrassment around things to do with our mental health or things that we know are kind of not normal and actually not really good for us. And are coming from, you know, because at the end of the day, the over-exercising comes from something psychological that's happening, right? That's why you're over-exercising in the first place. And thus it requires, you know, support with your psychological world to be able to overcome it. So that ability to be able to say, do you know what? This is not healthy. I don't want to live like this anymore. I know it's not good for me. I do not want to make myself unwell. I'm going to go and get the correct help. I'm going to go and get the correct support. That is my kind of advice around anything to do with food and exercise. If you are unsure, go and speak to somebody who can really help you and who can, you know, give you advice and give you tools and techniques that you can use to support yourself. The worst thing that you can do is to do nothing, I think, in these situations. The help exists, it is out there. There are lots of great eating disorder charities like Beat, which have lots of resources around eating disorders. They will around over-exercising as well. So it's just reaching out. And even if they don't have the right resources, they will be able to point you in the direction of an organization that does. So do not feel like you are on your own and that you cannot ask for help and support. We have come to the end of today's show, which, you know, I'm a little bit heartbroken about. It has been a great show. I wanted to say a huge thank you to my guests. I spoke to eating disorder dietitian specialist Talia Cicchelli, who joined me in the studio, and then I spoke to Race Across the World star Beth Mukherjee, all about her journey with MRK. Great chats, great interviews. And if you missed any of them, of course, you can go back and listen on all good podcasting platforms, and make sure you're following us on Instagram at What The Health Show. I'll be back next week from 11 a.m. for another jam-packed show.